Reactor online. Sensors online. Weapons online. All systems nominal.
Hello, everyone. It is Carrie here with Unicorn Company, welcoming you to another episode. Today, we will be talking more about Alpha Strike, something I've been a bit remiss in, and we'll be looking at the much maligned Scorpion Light Tank. First, though, let's get into some news. So first, the Alpha Strike box set is in the wild. Additionally, a new rec guide has come out. This one is number 27. And has a galleon on the cover. Catalyst has also released the ERS-2N Eris Premium Miniature. I apologize for the dog barking in the background. That's my neighbor. The Eris runs $14.99 and the Alpha Strike box retails for $79.99. I know I'm really looking forward to getting my hands on the box set and letting you know what I think of it. On the YouTube channel. With the box set on the horizon, and with one of my partners wanting to learn the game, I thought we would cover some interesting little things in Alpha Strike, as well as look at Rec Guide Ilclan Volume 26. So, I'm not going to do a tutorial on the entire game in this episode, but I want to go over some of the more odd basic rules in the game. The first of these is unequal number of units. Unlike many games where you move all your units and act, and then your opponent does the same, in Alpha Strike, movement is done in a back and forth manner, alternating the movement of units between each player. Where this can get complicated is in the case where one side has more units than the other. In a case like this, the player with more units has to move multiple so that each player has the same number of moves or turns moving. This is done by adding units to the move order towards the end of movement. So the Alpha Strike rulebook has a chart for this on page number 32. An easy way to do it, though, is to take two different colors of dice. Pretty much you get the one color represents your units, one your opponent. And so let's say you have 10 and your opponent has 7. You would lay out all 7 dice in a row for your opponent, and you'd lay out 7 of yours. And then starting at the end, you'd start putting one additional going back towards the beginning. So that way you just remove a pair of dice, one for you, one for your opponent, each time each of you moves. And then when you get to the 2 on your stack and 1 on theirs, you know that you have to move 2 and they move 1. And it's a very easy, very simple way to track movement. And since you would be using your dice anyway for tracking your movement modifier, it allows you to easily track your movement modifier and make sure that you all don't end up outside of that order, because that can happen, and when it does, it kind of sucks, especially if it messes up at the end where the person who doesn't have initiative ends up having an extra unit. So, you know, and by then everybody's already moved, and it's kind of weird. Another thing I wanted to mention in regards to movement is the movement types. There are 4 different ones, though you rarely see one of these used. In the main rules, you have ground movement, which is essentially a unit's standard movement with some notable exceptions. Jumping, which allows you to jump up to the distance on your card where it says J, like 6J or 7J, stuff like that. As well as over elevation up to half of your jump value, which a lot of people think it's the whole jump value. It's not. So if you have a jump of 8, you can jump over things that are 4 inches tall, which is a little bit different from the table from the classic BattleTech game, where if you have jump of 8 or jump of 6, you can jump over everything that is your jump number. So it's a little bit different, but it's not really a big deal. And I think the reason that they did that is because jump distance in Battletech does not equal jump height in Battletech, which gets really weird. So, yeah, it's sort of a little weird little thing in that movement mode. Then you have standstill, which is like bracing for a shot, essentially. And that gives you a -1 to your target, or not to your target move modifier, but to your target number when you're rolling to hit an enemy unit with an attack. So if you would normally need a 7, you would get a 6. You'd need a 6 to hit. And finally, sprinting, which isn't often used, as you can only run. You can only sprint while you sprint. You can't do any other actions. You can't drop off infantry. In scenarios, a lot of times you cannot claim the scenario, the claim the objectives, or con I think you might be allowed to contest in some. It depends on who's running it and what their rule set is. I don't know what the Wolfnet format says. I think in the Unicorn format you can, which I haven't gotten out into the wild yet, and I want to say at Southern Assault you could contest but not hold if you had sprinted. Now the only thing this changes is your distance. It is your normal movement times 1.5. It's only for ground movement. It does not change your movement modifier, so it doesn't make you any harder or easier to hit. It used to be a thing in, oh, I want to say, in before Commander's Edition came out, when you had Alpha Strike and Alpha Strike Companion, sprinting, I want to say it doubled your movement, actually. I might be wrong on that, but I do remember you were actually easier to hit. Also, evasion was a thing back then, which, oh, evasion was terrifying. But I'm glad it's not a standard rule. Sprinting is a standard rule. But yeah, sprinting can be useful if you have a really slow unit, you wanted to get it into cover or something like that to set up for actually using them on next turn. It also, it comes in handy if you really, really need to c contest an objective with something big or something like that. And then, of course, as I said, standstill really useful for if you have a unit that already has a 0 movement mod and has everybody in range, there's no point in moving. You just stand there, take whatever you're going to take, and unless it has a place that it needs to go to, you just take what you're going to get and you dish out more damage than you normally would because you've got a better roll to hit. So the next thing I want to look at, though, is something in the combat phase. One of the most overlooked things in the combat phase, which I've learned recently, actually, is who fires when. Now, veterans from Classic, such as myself, are used to declaration and firing. So each player declares all their targets, and then they resolve all the firing. And it doesn't matter who does it. This, though, is not how Alpha Strike operates. Instead, as it states on page 31, the person who lost initiative fires everything first. So you pretty much, the easiest way to do it is start on one side of the table and just work your way across to the other side. Then the person who won initiative does all their firing. After that, damage is all simultaneous. But this is the reason that you have this ability if you've won initiative. Let's say you're running a Black Hawk Prime, which I think is like a 5/5/0 with 4 overheat. If that Black Hawk Prime somehow gets totally just plastered, on, when your opponent fires everything, you still have the opportunity to shoot back, and you can just crank the heat all the way up, put out 9 damage, and hopefully take somebody with you. So there is a reason for that. And I know that many people, including myself, have gotten that wrong. Another thing I would like to mention is woods. Woods are interesting as if you are in them, the first 2 inches do not count for firing out, but give you a little bit of defense when you're being attacked. So if you are if you're in woods and within 2 inches of the edge, and you're shooting at a target, and there's less than 2 inches of woods between you and the target, you get a defensive modifier of +1 when they shoot at you. So their target number to hit you will go up by 1, but your target number will not be affected by those woods. Additionally, 6 inches of woods will block line of sight. And this makes it a very good type of position to have, as if you do get yourself in a nice big clump of woods, it can be pretty hard to dislodge someone, especially if they have any special abilities that enhance that even further, like mimetic armor or stealth or something like that. Woods can become a really nasty place to fight your opponent. The next thing I wanted to mention is partial cover, which is afforded to mechs. Vehicles do not get it, infantry do not get it, but it's afforded to them if more than one-third of a miniature is obstructed, but less than two-thirds. If more than two-thirds of a unit is obstructed, you do not have line of sight. Okay? So when you go to a game, there are two forms of line of sight for Alpha Strike. There's practical line of sight and true line of sight. In practical line of sight, I didn't write down the page number, but there is a little set of templates that show you how big a mech is, which I want to say is 2 inches by 1 inch or 1.25, a vehicle, infantry, all that. And it's called practical because technically you can take that template, sit it behind the cover. That's what you can see. And that was made mainly to allow for the extreme variations in miniature size between mechs that happened just through the process of designing and everything with the miniatures from like Ralpartha and Ironwind and stuff like that. And it's not their fault really. It's just that Battletech had a quote unquote scale, but nothing was ever to scale. It was the reality of the situation at the time, and when Alpha Strike was made, you had to have some way to compensate for that. With things getting more standardized, even within the 3D printing world, like for example, if you go to the Battletech International 3D Printing Facebook page, they have all the mech heights listed. So you have a range of where a mech is supposed to be. So if you're printing a Marauder, you can look at the Marauder thing for the Battletech 3D printing thing and know, okay, this is how tall a Marauder is supposed to be. It's pretty standardized in that regard. But if a model, regardless of true line of sight or practical line of sight, if more than two-thirds of the model is blocked, if you can only see an arm or like a weird fin on the top of the head or something like that, you cannot see the model. As far as game rules are concerned, you cannot see that unit to shoot it, and it cannot see you to shoot back. You two are blocked from line of sight. If more than a third of the model is blocked, and generally a good rule of thumb for this is if you can see the kneecaps and above, you're good. If you can see not the kneecaps and above, or not the kneecaps and below, the kneecaps are pretty much where you sort of want to use, like where I use for that third of a model thing, because it kind of gives you an idea. In a perfect world, all your line of sight blocking terrain is going to be like set at like about 24 millimeters and 24 millimeters to 44 millimeters, giving you perfectly, you know, level one, level two. In the real world, that's just not how it works. Of course, the other thing you can do, you can agree with your opponent, what is level one, thus creating a sort of weird mix of practical and true. That's not official, though. Officially, if you can't see more than a third of the model, you can't see the mech to shoot it. If you can't see more than a third of the tank, you can't see the tank. All of that. It's very specific on it. I do kind of like true line of sight in some ways, and I like practical in others. You know, because you will always have that person who will argue, well, I can see the arm of your mech, I can shoot. It's like, no, that's not more than a third of the miniature. I kind of wish they would go to a system like War Machine, where it's... And I know War Machine has its problems, don't get me wrong. But basically a practical line of sight system that creates a hexagon-shaped tube on the battlefield that is whatever the height they want it to be tall for a mech. And that is your what you can see. And then for infantry and everything, you just use the same hex, just whatever height it is, and use that. But that's kind of going off into a tangent of, you know, making it more, making it a little bit more practical for actual tournament use, which right now it's getting its legs under itself, but I can kind of see that becoming a thing in the future. Finally, in the combat phase, you have to decide if you're doing a physical or weapon attack, as you cannot do both in the same turn. In classic Battletech, you can walk up to somebody, shoot them with all your guns, and then kick them in the shin, quite literally. And after doing so, they may or may not fall to the ground. In Alpha Strike, nope. You get to do one or the other, but not both. So if you want to walk up and hit somebody physically, you can do that. If you want to shoot them, you can do that. I will say that the majority of the time, at the tournament level at least, it just works out better to shoot them. I know, like, some of the tactics that I've used in the past would not work now because of rules that have changed over the course of years. Like, for example, charging. Charging, the rules have changed so much from when I was able to pull off the trick with the fireballs. The experimental fireballs at Tennessee, where you literally would, because you didn't have to go in a straight line, you would just use 48 inches of movement and contact the enemy in the rear. And, yeah, all that movement, I forget the whole math behind it, but it came out ridiculously high for damage, and I think I took one damage in return, or no damage in return. Yeah. So, physical damage is not nearly as powerful as it is in Classic, and things like charges, death from above, stuff like that, they've been evolving because the rules for them have been broken in the past. So, I think this is a good point to stop, though, at least for today, for Alpha Strike stuff and little oddities and quirks in the rules. If you have any Alpha Strike questions, feel free to shoot me an email. Actually, don't shoot me an email. Go on to the Facebook group or the Discord. There will be links in the description below. You can catch me on a few different Discords. Usually it'll be like Carry Joe Magical Unicorn or something like that. But yeah, I frequent a lot of the different Discord groups, so you can catch me in there. And if you have any questions, feel free. Unicorn Company also has a Discord, and we do have the Facebook group. So, and on Twitter, at Unicorn Podcast One. The next thing I wanted to cover is the Recognition Guide. Recognition Guide Volume 26. Now, before I take a look at it, I did want to note that I like this format. Here's the reason. It spreads out all the new toys over a large amount of time and in small bundles. I feel this leads to like a higher quality of product and also gives us something to look forward to between releases. And I'm going to talk about this for a second real quick, I guess. I have a soapbox, I can use it, right? So back in the day, I sound like an old person. Well, I kind of am. Anyway, back in like the 90s, when I got into BattleTech, oh, that's so long ago. I gotta stop doing that. Back when I first got into BattleTech, my first technical readout was Technical Readout 3025, not the one with the redacted designs or anything like that. It was the original 3025 and the 2750, and then I got 3050. I want to say at that point I was kind of caught up with my TROs. So I had my three tech readouts, and mind you, I didn't have a lot of money to spend on gaming at the time. I lived in the middle of nowhere. I didn't have a job. I literally had like this little amount of money. You know, I was using Christmas money and allowance that I got for doing things and stuff like that. And oh my goodness, I need to give you all the backstory one day. I'm not going to do it right now, but. But what happened is you have different kinds of lore hounds in BattleTech. I am mainly a tech person. Like, I love the technology of the game. I love the walking robots. Well, the big stompy robots. Another, well, yeah, they are robots technically. They're just anyway. But I love the big stompy robots. I love all the technology and the. And yes, I know it's the technology of the future of the 1980s. And a lot of people now don't look at it that way, but it's like, yeah, it's the future of 1982. So computers were these massive things, or you know, it was not like it is now, where we have like laptops and phones or miniature computers themselves. But what kept me coming back to the game, or what kept me looking forward to books, were the new mechs. So it was like when the Luthien supplement came out, I had to get the book, not for the scenarios. I didn't give a shit about the scenarios. I needed to see what new toys were in the back. The Cauldron Born, with the best art for the Cauldron Born ever, was in that book. The Noble Rainin, the Hankyu. I needed to see those. That was what I was getting it for. And it's been like that with all of the releases. Does it have a mech in the back of the book? I don't care about everything else. When the Periphery Source Book came out, it was the Marshall. I needed to get it because it had the Marshall in the book. And the only way I could get that info was there was no Sarna. There was none of that other stuff. So the tech readout format was the biggest part of it for me because tech readouts would come out every so often. But they came out every so often. And for a person like me who loves the tech readouts and likes to read about like the weird quirks behind the designs of the mechs and the weird histories and all of that, the rec guides, every 2 weeks, there's new toys. New pretty shiny toys that I can look at and read about, and it gives me time to consume the last ones. So, like, for example, the last rec guide group they did was 24 issues. That's every 2 weeks, 24 issues. That's 48 weeks. That's an entire year of my life that I got to look forward to getting new toys every couple weeks just to see what was in the book. You know, it's like, oh my God, what is in there this time? What do I get to read about? And some of them have been like amazingly awesome. Like, I'm not going to spoil it, but Rec Guide 27 has one of my favorite mechs in it. And it's like, oh my God, yes. So yeah, that's kind of why, one of the reasons I like this format. The other is it keeps people like me coming back. It gives me something to look forward to in the short term that is not, you know, is not like a big product. It's not a huge product. It doesn't need a huge ton of development. So yeah, and they could literally backlog a bunch of stuff, have it sitting there waiting, and just work the product through an entire year. And it's going to make them money consistently over the course of that year. Because there are people like me who will always want to have the tech readouts, who will always go ahead and hunt them down and be like, yes, this is, I need this. And yeah. So with all of that said, and you understanding why I really enjoy it, why I think it's a good business model for Catalyst. I mean, I think they probably make more doing rec guides than they do tech readouts anyway, because it's a portion. I forget how much they charge. It's not a lot. But yeah, it's spread out over for the time. You don't realize how much you're paying for it, which I know it sounds horrible. But you know, you don't look at like $3 at a time or whatever. So yeah, that's kind of, I like it because it helps them. I like it because it, yeah. So anyway, let's get into Rec Guide 26. The first unit we see is the Condor Heavy Hover Tank in the Ultra configuration, which is new for the Rec Guide. The design looks solid with a mix of clam and inner sphere equipment. As far as the new art itself, I feel like it doesn't feel right. As the Condor, how it's depicted in City Tech, was actually quite good. And the new one looks unrecognizably different. And that's from either the 3026 or the City Tech art. I feel like it doesn't feel like the same tank at all. It feels like they phoenixed it. The next entry is the Merlin. This isn't one that I have paid too much attention to in the past, as it always struck me as a lackluster unit at best. The art for the machine in TR 3055 was atrocious and was cleaned up very well in experimental tech readout Boondocks. Now, if we look at them, the XTR Boondocks and the new one, you know, I'll go into the art in a second. Well, let's go into the tech part of it. And I'm not going deep. This isn't like a mech tech. But the entry is the MLN-1D, which is a 60-tonner. Carries a PPC, two light PPCs, and an LRM-5. Also, it has a flamer and a heavy machine gun. It's respectfully armored with 10.5 tons and moves 4.64, which is decent for a low-end heavy trooper at 60 tons. The other variant is the Merlin C, which we're seeing a lot more of the C variants, which I do like because it makes sense that the clans have refit inner sphere designs, especially in the Dark Ages and in the Ill Clan era. The payload on the C is similar, has an ERPPC, two heavy medium lasers, Streak LRM-5, a flamer, and a heavy machine gun. Moves the same as the 1D and has 12 tons of armor. Now, aesthetically, let's get into the aesthetics on this. I think I would go with the XTRO Boondocks version. It feels like it has more character. Now, the new one feels too much like a thug. as far as like looking at it. Like the new Thug art is awesome, but the new Merlin art looks a lot like the new Thug art. The next unit is the Naga 2, which in the lore is essentially a reskinned woodsman with new configurations. The design carries a decent amount of base heat sinks and has more than respectable speed, which allows it to keep up with a Mad Cat, which does give it an advantage over the original woodsman design. But it does carry a light amount of armor for a mech of its size with 9 tons on an 80-ton chassis. It has 31.5 tons of pod space, which lets it carry some interesting weapons configurations. If you imagine that a Mad Cat and a Loki had a baby, that's essentially what you have here. Visually in the torso, it gives you a very woodsman feel. And to be fair, that is what I thought we had here when the preview of the cover came out. The arms and legs look like they are almost pulled straight from the Man of War with the removal of the SRM launchers on the arms. Now, in the three-unit spread, there's 2 3-unit spreads in the back. We have an updated look Maxim, which feels more in line with its older art, just updated. Then the Condor, the Flea, which pulls heavily from the FLE-16 of TRO Succession Wars, with only slight changes. And a Hermes 2, which feels lackluster at best. It's hard to not mix it up with an Enforcer. There's a second page of updated designs as well, with a very recognizable Star Slayer and Quick Draw, as well as a new Caesar that has the feel of the original with a better look. All right, now I do have a hot take here, so some of you may not like this, in that I'm not the biggest fan of some of the new art, the redesigns. There are 2 reasons for this. The first is that oftentimes these designs are too blocky or are too generic in their look. As we now have units spanning roughly 400 years with the same design language. To put that in perspective, it would be like if the Sherman tank or the Lee persisted into the 2300s and its design language was being carried by every unit anyone designed for that entire period. I mean, could you imagine an Abrams looking like a Sherman? Now, I understand the need for the redesigns, but I also feel they should be done in a way that helps differentiate them better through their design language. You should be able to look at a mech and tell, oh, that's a Star League mech. It has certain lines to it. It has certain... And that was the whole thing. Like, they dropped a lot of the hard, straight lines in Tech Readout 2750. Specifically because the Star League was known for having more curved plate armor, stuff like that. It was... Like the original Marauder with the basically the Zendentry, I can't pronounce it, pod, that big curved back to it and all that. That was indicative of the design language of the Star League. A lot of curves, a lot of almost organic look to some of it. The Champion is a good example of this. The Crab, with that curved body, The Sentinel, unfortunately, was a pool ball with legs. The Kintaro. Now, mind you, I'm not defending a lot of this art. A lot of this art is needed to be redone. Some of it, not as much as others. We had a perfectly serviceable, beautiful... I shouldn't say serviceable. It's a beautiful metal Highlander that people are still doing amazing things with. And I prefer way over the new plastic Highlander. But it was felt that that needed a redesign more than, say, the Champion, which definitely needed the redesign. The Crab, which had immeasurable problems in the whole leg setup, needed a, not the Crab, but the King Crab, needed a redesign. The Crab itself, it needed a little work. The arms were kind of funky. It did not need the torso moved up to the front of the body, which, yeah, you'd have to be laying down to operate it the way they have it configured. But yeah, so, you know, aesthetically, I think that they should do more to differentiate between when these mechs were designed and built and stuff like that. Mean, that's kind of my, you know, my thing that I don't think people are gonna agree with. And excuse me, I do not mean to yawn in your ear. But yeah, I think that's, you know, it's a pretty reasonable hot take of all, if anything. I just feel like the design language needs to be more expressive of when a mech is built. Like, for example, the clans, the original clan invasion mechs, very specific design language to them, even with the redesigns. When you start getting past that, it starts to muddy. So, all right, give me one second. All right, so before we get into our vehicle tech today, because we're going to be covering a tank, I want to go ahead and mention our sponsor, Fortress Games and Miniatures. Now, Fortress, obviously, they are my sponsor, but I did want to go ahead and let you know. Pretty much let you know about them. They do carry a number of products, just about everything you would need for Battletech, including Ironwood Metal, Catalyst Game Labs, Fighting Piranha Graphics miniatures. They carry Battlefield in the Box stuff from Battlefront. They have a whole section of Battletech previously owned items. So if you are looking for one of the old source books or one of the old tech readouts, you know, you can go ahead and scour their page and see what they have. And you know, go ahead and give it a look, because they have some awesome stuff on their page, and I highly recommend them. So when you get a chance, go ahead and check them out. Now, let's get into today's vehicle tech segment, I guess. So the Scorpion, the little tank that could sometimes. All right, so the Scorpion was initially produced in 2807 by Quixel. Quixel has a reputation for making shoddy products, getting them out quickly, and being dirt cheap. In fact, I believe some of their vehicles are actually flat packed and sent places, such as the Hetzer, if I recall correctly. Now, this design, the Scorpion, is so prolific that it has been produced by Quixel, by Joint Equipment Systems, by Benson and Bjorn, by Hellespont Industries, and by Aldus Industries. So it is not like something that this vehicle, it's either being licensed out a lot or it is just being copied all the time because of how simple it is. So what is essentially a budget tank can be found just about everywhere in the Inner Sphere. It's in the periphery. Everybody has these. Now, the original version of it is a light tank and it's tracked. It weighs only 25 tons, and has a maximum speed of 64 kilometers an hour, with an autocannon 5 on the turret and a single hull-mounted machine gun, and has a battle value of 306. So this thing is dirt cheap, and there are tons of variants. There's the LRM variant. It replaces the autocannon with two LRMs, a 5 and a 10, and has a battle value of 325. There's an SRM variant, basically turns it into a little SRM carrier with two SRM 6s and 3 tons of ammunition. Comes in at 373. So if you are, you don't want to buy an LRM carrier, or you just don't have time to get one, you can rip out the cannon and slap some missiles on this thing. There's a medium laser variant. It has two medium lasers instead of the autocannon, which actually improves its damage output at the cost of range. And also carries a ton of cargo. So I guess technically this thing is good for extended operations. Has a battle value of 320. Another missile variant that came out after the invention of medium range missiles is the MRM version, and it has an MRM-20 in place of the autocannon. Has a battle value of 393. And of course, you also have other versions as well with autocannons, such as the light autocannon version, which came out in 3072, and it swaps out the single AC-5 for two light autocannon 2s with 45 rounds of ammunition. And yeah, I mean, all of them, I believe, retain the machine gun. Then you have two minesweepers. So there was a prototype version, Capellan Confederation Armed Forces tried out at first, and they pretty much yanked the turret off, kind of like the Kangaroo Sherman. And put two forward-firing LRM-5 launchers on it with 3 tons of ammunition. And essentially, what it does is it uses mine-clearing ammunition to shoot at minefields and hopefully blow them up. It did add a ton of modular armor to make it a little bit safer, I guess. Comes in at a battle value of 350. Then you have the Aldous Industries version of the Minesweeper, which is a full production version. This one uses a fuel cell engine instead of internal combustion. Has 6 tons of hardened armor. So this thing is a nice little tiny turret. And has that pair of LRM-5s with 3 tons of ammo and a machine gun. Has a battle value of 452. And finally, you have the Desert Scorpion. Now, the Desert Scorpion is interesting because this shows how much you can change the design based on what you want. On the world of Stotzing, they basically stripped the scorpions and they stripped the scorpion internally. They took it apart from the inside out. They replaced the internal combustion engine with a 125 rated fusion engine that increased its ground speed from the 64 kilometers an hour to 84 kilometers an hour. It replaced the autocannon with a large laser and added an extra machine gun on the turret, so pretty much a coax. In addition to that, it has 7 tons of armor and case for its ammunition. So this thing is no joke. This is going from literally the bargain basement, El Cheapo, like dollar store tank that costs 327,000 C-bills to a full-on line tank that weighs 25 tons and is carrying 7 tons of armor. This thing has like actual real armor to it, and it has case so the crew doesn't die when the ammunition explodes. Has a battle value of 554. This is a beautiful little tank. And so I mean this is just looking at it in classic, which in classic it has a role. It's there to fill points, but it's also there to be a pain in the butt. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. It just does its job and it does it well. And people do not like you for it. But then you have the Alpha Strike side of things, and that's where this gets interesting. So we'll start with the Scorpion Light Tank, your standard everyday Scorpion. Oh, that was my 3D printer. I apologize about that. All right, so Scorpion Light Tank. Combat value, size 1, TMM of 1, movement of 8, tracked, roll as brawler, point value 11. So most of that base part there, the type, size, target movement modifier, movement, are not going to change. They will change on the Desert Scorpion, but we'll get to that when we get to that. Has armor of 2, structure of 2. Specials are EE, search, and turret of 111, has short, medium, and long of 1. This is nothing special. This is less than a squad of battle armor a lot of times. It's not going to get you a lot of results. It won't be as effective in some things. But, yeah, it's there. It's a little tiny tank. And it plinks away at things. So then we have the, I don't have the thing in front of me where I could see which versions I was looking at. Okay, there we go. All right, so then we have the LRM Scorpion. So let's take a look at the LRM. So the LRM Scorpion, that first part stayed the same. It's a missile boat this time and has a point value of 14. Short, medium, and long are all 1. Has armor of 3 and structure of 2. So it's actually better armored. Specials are EE, IF1, so indirect fire, searchlight, turret of 111, and indirect fire 1. If you really want a small little missile boat, this is it. It's not going to do a lot, but it'll do something. Next, we get into the SRM version of the Scorpion Light Tank. This one's interesting. Okay, so this one comes in at 13 points. That baseline of stats, the combat value, all that stays roughly the same. All stays the same, actually. It's an ambusher instead this time. To be fair, if I were to think of taking a Scorpion in a tournament environment, it might be this one. I have to see what the Desert Scorpion looks like. Has damage values of 2 at short and medium, no long range value. Armor of 2, structure of 2, specials are EE, searchlight, SRM of 2-2, turret 2-2-0, SRM 2-2. So this one follows those guidelines that I like to put out there of forget long range, because long range does you no favors in a competitive format unless you're playing on a 6x4. So don't worry about long range. You know, look for higher damage and look for it at a value. This is all of that right here in the design. It's also the most damage output that we've seen on any of the Scorpions so far. Next, you have the medium laser variant. The type, size, TMM, all that are the same again. It is once again an ambusher. Excuse me. Comes in at 11 points. Armor of 2, structure of 2. Has specials of cargo transport 1, because you always need that cargo transport. EE, searchlight, turret 2-1-0. It's pretty much a slightly different version of the Scorpion, the standard Scorpion. Then we have the MRM version. The MRM version. Ooh. This one I like because it's a little bit cheaper than the SRM. Type, size, TMM, movement, all the same as the first one. It's a brawler this time. Point value is 13. Short and medium of 2, long of 0, armor and structure of 2. EE Searchlight Turret 220. And the reason it's 1 point cheaper is because you don't have the SRM ability. So you're paying for an ability. In a tournament format, unless you're using NARC beacons, the SRM ability is pointless. Because they don't let you take Inferno. Oh, God, if they let me take Inferno rounds, I would... Oh, people would hate me. People would hate me for days. Because there are some designs that, just for any of the special ammunition for SRMs, oh, the armor piercing SRM ammo. Oh, because that still does the damage, and you get an armor penetration hit chance. Mm. Yeah, scary, right? So, yeah, this one I would actually move up ahead of the SRM version because it's 1 point cheaper, does the exact same thing. You know, low cost. Better damage, same damage output. After that, we have the light autocannon variant. Now, this is the cheapest variant. This one comes in at 10. And mind you, this is newer technology that they have on board. But it's so sad. So to combat the CV, size 1, TMM1, 8, tracked. It's a brawler. 10 points. Short 1, medium and long are 0 with a star, which means you have to roll to hit, and you have to roll to see if you actually do damage. Armor is 2, structure is 2, specials are EE, search, and turret 0 star at all 3 range brackets. You poor thing. Yeah. This poor little tank. Like, when you thought it couldn't get any worse, it... Yeah. So then we have the minesweepers. You have the prototype and the production. The prototype comes in at 12 points. It's actually slower. It's combat value size, or combat vehicle size 1, TMM1, movement of 6, tracked, missile boat for 12 points, short, medium, and long of 1, armor and structure of 2, EE, indirect fire 1, MSW, Minesweeper special ability, and Searchlight. So, yeah, it's pretty much a Minesweeper, but it's as effective as the standard variant. In campaign play, I could see this being useful to have. In tournament play, not so much, simply because there's no mines. So it's not a worry. And then you have the production minesweeper variant, which is 14 points. This one is combat value, combat vehicle, size 1, TMM1, movement 8 inches, tracked. Missile boat, once again, short, medium, and long of 1. Armor of 3, structure of 2, special of crit resistant. FC, I don't remember what FC does. I don't feel like looking it up, but I don't... Dang it. Fire control. Indirect fire 1, minesweeper, and searchlight. It's not a bad little design. It's just... I don't think it's worth the 14, especially in a competitive format. In a campaign, you'd need to have a minesweeper sitting around somewhere to do, like, minesweeper work. But otherwise, yeah. It's... It's just an oddity. And then we have the Desert Scorpion. Stotzing's version of the tank, which is 17 points. All right, so 17 points. And remember, I mentioned all the mods they did to this tank. It's a fusion engine. It's got a large laser. It's not nearly... as good as you would hope. All right, so it's combat value, size 1, TMM of 2, so it's a little harder to hit. Movement of 10, tracked. Has no roll. Like I'm looking at the card, no roll. Roll, none. Short, medium. Short is 2, medium is 1, long is 0. Armor is 4, and structure is 2. Specials are case, searchlight, turret 110. Point value is 17. Okay, so, oh, why do you have to be, if it was 220, it would feel better, but it's not. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Out of curiosity, it's not unique. Like it's available to the Free Worlds League through from Clan Invasion all the way to Ill Clan era, but that's no bueno. I don't like that. It doesn't feel right that it has like no role, which I know doesn't matter, but I mean it matters if you're using formations. That and it costs so much for, I mean, I can buy two standard scorpions for this, and yeah. Or an MRM scorpion and give it a skill upgrade, and it's gonna do more damage consistently, even though it'll die. But that's what scorpions do. Yeah, I mean, scorpions. Okay, so, all right. Yes, I'm lamenting the scorpion, but at the same time, the scorpion has its place in Alpha Strike, where these are really fun, is in a campaign, because these can be some of your what's the best word I'm looking for here? Your nameless henchmen, so to speak. In numbers, they're a threat. By themselves, they're not. Like if you catch one on its own, it dies. It just zip dead. Okay, whatever. But if there's like a lance of them floating around somewhere, or a few different patrols of them that you have to avoid, or that you have to take out, those little plinky guns are going to add up. And I have firsthand one of my favorite things, because I played a game one time where there were no limits on the number of units you could take, but you had to all be in faction. So I ended up taking a Lance of Mechs, a Lance of Heavy and Assault Mechs, and essentially a company of scorpions. I have never seen anything so terrifying as like a Deshi get swarmed with tanks. Like just completely surrounded and swarmed by little scorpion tanks. And they just plinked it to death. And then one of them, I think it was a gladiator, the clan mech, it was sitting at long range, and the Deshi was all but dead at this point. So it shoots at that, gets a crit, rolls a 12 on its hit, rolls a 12 on the location, and one shots a freaking clan assault mech. The scorpion is like that little tiny scary monster that doesn't do much. It's like a piranha. One of them's not going to do a lot. A pack of them will eviscerate you. And that is what is so scary about the scorpion, because they are so cheap. And they are so like in tournament play, yes, a scorpion you might throw in there if you have the extra points sitting around, but you're probably going to get battle armor instead because it's going to give you more utility. In campaign and narrative play, a good game master is going to use the scorpion like the little henchman. It's not a threat by itself. But when it brings its friends, and then its Onto's friend shows up and starts flinging stuff at you, then you have to worry, you know? So, I guess in a way, this mech tech, this vehicle tech, is dedicated to all the little tiny things out there that by themselves, they're not scary at all. But when you get a bunch of them all together, yeah. They can be terrifying. So that is it for today's episode. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you like what we're doing here, if you like the podcast, please go to patreon.com/unicorncompany. You can support the podcast there. I would also encourage you, obviously, go to Fortress, Fortress Miniatures and Games. You know, let them know that we're, you know, we are where they found, where you found them. But yeah, and also keep an eye in the description. You will, or look in the description, you will find our Facebook page. Should be a Discord link, should be a Patreon link, and also a link to our sponsor. So that is it for tonight. Everybody out there, have a great day, great evening, great weekend, wherever you are. This is Unicorn Actual, signing off. I'm gonna find my meaning, I can make a change, I wanna play the game. You wanna sink or swim, I'm gonna go down swinging. Look deep within.